Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome a guest co-host today, Dr. Nathan Sison from UNC Family Medicine. Welcome, Nathan.
Thanks for having me.
We've got a great show in store today for our listeners. I really think we're going to be talking with the Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Mandy Cohen, about her vision for healthcare in our state, including the amazing opioid action plan the state is developing to deal with a serious health concern.
Absolutely. We see tons of patients in the Family Medicine Center and all over the state with opioid problems.
Yeah, well, we'll look forward to that conversation. But first, we actually have some really interesting research that matters. Let's dive right in. This first study is about cancer and alcohol. Does that surprise you at all?
Not really. Alcohol has long been known to cause irritation to the surfaces of the mucosa when we drink, so from the throat to the mouth to the gums. And this research looks like it just puts some numbers to that.
Yeah, this was actually a statement published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology by the American Society of Clinical Oncology, really kind of summarizing evidence about alcohol and, as you said, cancers. And one of the things they really point out is that particularly for women, even light drinking can raise a woman's risk of breast cancer as well as esophageal cancer. That to me is actually a little bit of a new information that even light drinking actually probably raises a cancer risk.
Yeah. Especially when you consider light drinking as defined is only one drink a day, so seven drinks a week, which we often counsel patients on, is appropriate drinking.
Perhaps there was some research that came out years ago that, you know, if you had a drink a day, your heart attack risk went down over compared to if you had no alcohol. But that doesn't mean that people, particularly women, should be having a drink every single day.
That's right.
Not the same thing, right?
That's correct.
What do you think we should do with this data? Because it really actually shows that there's a continuum. So for women who were actually drinking more than that or heavy drinking, they had significantly increased risk of cancers, that as well as men if they're drinking heavily. And I know I've seen, you know, some of my patients who've drunken heavily and they've had cancers of the throat and the esophagus and the liver and the mouth. I've seen these things.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to it just being one more risk factor we need to consider. So if a patient is also a smoker or has a family history of these cancers, those sorts of patients may need to be counseled to curb their drinking.
Yeah, just for our listeners, this Society of Clinical Oncology recommends or says that the data shows that 5.5% of all new cancers and 5.8% of all cancer deaths worldwide are attributed to alcohol. I think that should raise some eyebrows.
Yeah, it's a significant number of patients.
Well, let's talk about the next research that matters. And this is research that came out of the University of North Carolina, and it looks at hormone replacement therapy and depression. Help us understand a little bit, Nathan, what we're talking about.
This is a study, like you said, out of the University of North Carolina here in Chapel Hill that looked at women who were either in menopause or around the time of menopause, and they were given estrogen treatment. And it's long been known that this helps with some of the other symptoms of menopause, but this study posits that it also helps with depression.
Now, this was actually a randomized controlled trial where they followed these women for a year, and the women who were given the hormone replacement, the estrogen and the progesterone combination, 17% of them developed clinically significant depression. Now, that's not causal because if you look at the group that wasn't on it, 32% of those women who got the placebo became depressed. And that's a significant difference. And we know that the menopause is such a heightened risk for women developing things like depression. I guess I'm struck by two things. One, by how much depression comes about in these women who don't get a medication. And then there was a significant reduction.
Yeah, it seems like it could be helpful for certain women, but the article also does point out that not all women who have menopausal symptoms, including depression, should be given this medication.
Yeah, the great majority actually don't develop depression, and then it doesn't really deal with, I think, a significant issue, which is side effects.
Right.
Right. How many of the women who are given hormonal therapy will have side effects, whether that's from to their blood pressure, whether it's due to clotting or whether it's due to bleeding? Those are also issues. So there really has to be a risk-benefit discussion, right? This isn't just one thing, but this is a discussion.
It is one that you should have with your doctor.
I will say I will drink water to that. But the last research, which actually water would be helpful for, is things that people do to lose weight, including drinking water. Would actually, could their partner lose weight at the same time that the patient or the person who's in the weight loss program lose weight? What they call the ripple effect. I love that.
Yeah, it's great. And it also makes sense, especially when you consider that they were looking at couples, so people who cohabitated with each other. Usually means that you respect that person and you admire them to a certain degree and do a lot of the same things with them. So if one person's eating in a different way, you might also eat in a different way.
Yeah, and what I liked about this, and this was out of the University of Connecticut, and they tracked kind of weight loss of 130 couples over 6 months, they found if one of the partners who was actually kind of in the program successfully lost weight, the partner actually successfully lost weight, even though they weren't in the program. On the converse side, if the kind of the target patient didn't lose weight, then the partner actually didn't lose weight, which to me really suggests, which is kind of obvious, but probably not easy, which is we should consider the family unit, the social support network, when we're trying to change behavior. That's obvious.
Yeah, it is, especially when it comes to cooking meals, which is usually falls to one person primarily.
Yeah, we've just started some, I think, interesting research with cancer patients whom we're trying to get to quit smoking and thinking, well, what if we take the networks where a lot of them are smoking and help them quit as a group? Is that going to actually be more effective? This would suggest in terms of weight that it probably would.
Yeah.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. I think we've had a chance to really talk about some interesting research. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Mandy Cohen, Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, about her vision for healthcare in our state and the origination of the Opioid Action Plan. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Nathan Sisson. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we're talking with the Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Mandy Cohen, about the opioid crisis and some of the major priorities of the state and really the United States of America. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks so much for having me, Adam.
You're still a relative newcomer to the South and North Carolina, but you're not a newcomer to healthcare and to leadership. Tell us how you really became interested in becoming a physician and in healthcare and health policy.
Yes. So by background, I'm an internal medicine physician. My mother is a nurse practitioner. She's been one for 40 years. She still works full time at night in an emergency room. And so I watched her interact with her patients, with the healthcare system as I was growing up. And it was something where I knew I wanted to be part of the healthcare system, but I also saw a lot of the issues of the healthcare system through her eyes, because often we see many parts of the broken system in the emergency room. And so when I was going to school, I also worked on the Hill. I worked for the late Senator Kennedy when he was ranking member of the HELP committee. So I had some exposure there. And so always wanted to figure out how I could bring the clinical aspects of medicine together with how the system is run. And so I've had a fantastic opportunity to be able to do both of those things throughout my career. So I went to medical school, trained in internal medicine at Mass General, and then was able to had the opportunity at first to work for the Veterans Administration, the largest integrated healthcare system in our country, and work with women veterans and making sure they were getting good care and work on the policy side as well. And then I spent my last, before joining the team here in North Carolina, I spent the last 8 years at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, where I held a number of roles there. The ones most immediate, I was chief operating officer and chief of staff there, so that means I had purview over Medicare, Medicaid, and the federal health exchanges. So it was an incredible opportunity to see the federal government at work and how many lives it touches, but I'm so happy to be here in North Carolina to really think about how we in the state can use all of the levers and tools that we have at DHHS to drive a healthier state overall and really think about the health and well-being of folks across the state. So it's been an incredible ride for me over the last, you know, 20 years of my career, and happy to be here in the state taking on this incredible role as Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Well, we're thrilled and excited that you're here. And I must say, I had the pleasure of hearing you talk not too long ago and talk about some of the your priorities and the governor's priorities. And I wonder if you could mention kind of the three priorities that I heard then about early childhood development and Medicaid reform. And then I know we're going to do a really deep dive into opioids, and that's near and dear. But I'd love to hear just a little bit about that broader vision of what's really needed, at least in the state of North Carolina, if not nationally.
Sure. Well, first, I've been here in North Carolina almost a year to the day as we're talking. And, you know, what I did when I first arrived is really try to get to understand where the state was and what is top of mind for our various stakeholders, what is needed amongst our patients and other consumers who we serve, what do our doctors need, our hospitals, what is top of mind for the General Assembly, who I need to work closely together with. And that is really where the priorities came from. And so is really listening and learning from them about where should we focus our efforts, and then map that to the tools and levers that we have here at the department, which is why it's not surprising that we are focusing on three major areas. I know we'll dive deep into the opioid crisis, but because it was a crisis and so important that to take a it takes a major effort to combat a crisis, and so it was one of our first areas of focus. It was a place where we could bring together a lot of folks, so I'm excited we'll spend some time diving deep on that. But second, we are focused on our Medicaid transformation efforts. Before I joined the team here in North Carolina, there was a change in state law to move from a state-administered Medicaid program to a managed care or an insurance company-administered Medicaid program. And so my role is really to use that change as an opportunity to drive improvement across the system. So I really, while change is really hard, and I think it will be a challenge for our state, I think it's also a great opportunity to think about how do we use the tools that managed care can give the state to drive better quality, to drive more accountability, and drive ultimately better outcomes for the people of North Carolina. And so that's a big amount of effort. And for me, I'm also using that as an opportunity to think broadly about health and not just about health care. And so thinking about what are all of the components that go into someone's health. And we know that is more than just what goes on within the four walls of a hospital or my own clinic, right? So we've been thinking very broadly about health and how do we use our tools and levers to really think about using all of our dollars and resources to buy health. We know that means we need to buy things and buy services and interventions that are beyond the four walls of a hospital and a clinic. So some exciting work there I would love to dive into if we have the opportunity, but that's one chunk, and that's a lot of the work that we heard, again, from our stakeholders. And then the third bucket is really thinking about early childhood education and health. And this is thinking about how do we really get upstream as far as we possibly can to really intervene early in both a child's life around their health. Are they loved? Are they safe? And are they ready to learn once they get to school? And so that is what we are really focused on. And if 2017 for the department was really a focus on galvanizing efforts around the opioid crisis, I hope 2018 to be us really pulling together as a team across the department to think about early childhood health and education, because I think we touched the lives of children in so many ways, of children and their families in so many ways from the department. So how do we do that in a much more coordinated and strategic way to really get the most out of everything that we're doing?
Well, and it seems as if these issues are clearly related. If we don't take care of children and families and the support when they're young, and we have problems that develop with substance abuse, and then we don't have a healthcare system where treatment can occur easily,
exactly, right?
The trifecta problem. But I want to ask you one question specifically about Medicaid. You did something radical. You actually asked providers to give you their opinions. What did you learn?
Well, I don't think it's that radical, being that I'm a doctor myself, and I want to make sure we're building a system that works for those who are actually delivering the care within it. And I know change is challenging. As a doctor, I've been through some of that change myself, and it is challenging. And so we wanted to make sure that we were being thoughtful about, you know, as we're making the changes, what are the ways in which we can do that and support providers throughout it. I mean, look, I will say, number one, we learned a lot that managed care was not everyone's first choice. And I recognize that and I understand that, but the law is what I am charged to carry out. And so my goal is to make it the best managed care program possible for those that we serve and those providers who are serving our beneficiaries. So within that, you know, we wanted to think about how do we build a system that supports providers. So transparency was a big thing. Making sure that we are being transparent about the decisions we're making. How can we also reduce administrative burden, right? How do we make sure that the hassle factor of being involved in the Medicaid program is as low as possible? So really trying to think through, can we, for example, streamline credentialing so that a provider doesn't have to get credentialed by each and every insurance company, but you get credentialed once and then you're credentialed for the Medicaid program. So that's what we heard a lot, is how can you help reduce administrative burden? And then it was also, look, there's a lot of great things around care coordination that are working right now in the Medicaid program, particularly with the pediatric population. How do we make sure we preserve the things that are working as we make this transition? So we've been getting a lot of really good feedback from providers around that, and how do we not only preserve it, but like I said, take it to that next level. So we've been doing a lot of work around a concept called the advanced medical home. So we've had a lot of medical homework. And so how do we take it to that next level? So it's been a lot of really good feedback, you know, and continued very good dialogue with doctor community and the nursing community and all the others who deliver services to our Medicaid beneficiaries.
So keeping the good and get rid of the bad and be transparent in both.
That's right. Good summary.
Yeah, that's great. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to dive down to understand why the opioid issue is so important, not only for North Carolina, but for our nation. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Mandy Cohen, Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, about her vision for a healthier North Carolina. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Mandy Cohen, Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, about the vision for a healthier North Carolina. And right before the break, Dr. Cohen, you really shared some of the priorities around early childhood health care and development and work on Medicaid reform. And I know a major issue that takes up your time, it takes up time of everyone around the state, is the opioid crisis, and it really is a crisis, and it seems to be really personal for each and every North Carolinian. Tell me, what did you see and know that this was something that was going to be something that you had to make a difference?
I think for me as a physician, and knowing how the crisis and learning more about the crisis and the fact that it really did unfortunately start with some of my own prescription pad, right? And thinking about something that I wanted to do really well for my patients, which is control pain. But I think we didn't fully understand all of the challenges and the hugely addictive nature of some of the opioid medicines that we were using to treat pain. And we've gone down this an unfortunate road with some of our patients. I mean, I had a young woman patient of mine who was a dancer and, you know, had some various back issues and wanted to make sure that she could go to work and do the work that she needed to do. And unfortunately, even just a small amount of pain medicine over the course of just a few weeks, unfortunately, re-triggered that in the past she had had some difficulties with addiction that we hadn't discussed before I wrote that prescription. And it set off a number of years for her of just a horrible cycle of, you know, into a heavy addiction cycle. And luckily for her, after a number of years, she was able to, you know, recover and get the treatment that she needed. But it caused her to at first lose her job and was separated from her children for a while. And so, you know, I've seen this, you know, up close and personal, but I think so have so many doctors and nurses and family members. They've seen it personally. They've seen it in their offices. And it is a hard and complex problem. We knew we got here because a lot of things have gone wrong all together at the same time, which means we need a lot of help from all different types of sectors to right the ship. And that is what we've been focused on, is how do we bring everyone together and use the state as a catalyst and a convener to drive us all together to work in a coordinated way. And that's why we launched a statewide opioid action plan last year. And it's not, right, just putting the action plan together does not mean you've solved anything, but it does give us a structure and something to come back to make sure that we are focused on the things we should focus on every day to fight this crisis.
Yeah, and I know we're gonna talk about that in just a minute. I wonder, though, if you could help frame a little bit, because we're not just talking about use and we're not just talking about abuse or even really addiction. We're talking an epidemic of deaths, unintentional, even sometimes intentional, and it's opiates and heroin. And I was struck. I mean, this is personal. I have family members, friends, others who have dealt with this, and I know how painful it is. But I was even so struck when I looked at the data of North Carolina and many other states around the country around things like heroin.
Yes, where we had been seeing deaths from opioids in the hundreds, in the low hundreds, for a number of years. Really, in just the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen that skyrocket to where in 2017, we're just seeing the early total death data. We think that there's about 1,500 deaths. So we went from about 200 or so, and now we're all the way up to 1,500 a year deaths. And that is after we've seen EMS and other administer naloxone, the medicine that reverses an overdose, more than 16,000 times, right? So imagine we didn't have that ability to reverse those overdoses. I think that death toll would be much higher. So it has been really extreme. And what we are seeing now is that most of the death rate is really from heroin and fentanyl, or synthetic derivatives of fentanyl. And those are really what is causing the deaths. And so we're really trying to get the word out so folks understand the progression of the crisis. It did start with pain pills like OxyContin, but now what we're really seeing is that's really a gateway to heroin and fentanyl. That is really the deadly aspect here. But we are focusing our energy and making sure folks are aware of that and know that there are medicines out there that can help treat the addiction. Like any chronic disease, we need to treat substance use disorder as a disease, which means long-term access to treatment.
Yeah, and I know you believe wholeheartedly what I used to hear from the Center for Disease Control, that overdose are not an accident, but they're preventable. Mm-hmm. And tell us about your opioid action plan, because it has these incredible dimensions that I want to put my arms around. You use health and medicine and law enforcement and education, the business sector, the nonprofit sector, and even government. Help us understand it.
Sure. So we try to distill things down into the, you know, evidence-based practices that work and want to make sure we are relying on all of the different levers we had, to your point. We need the law enforcement. We need our educators. We need all of our doctors and nurses. So we looked across the country, looked at all the evidence to see what are the places we should focus on. And none of them are brand new. I think these are all things that have been done in North Carolina, maybe in pockets in certain places, but what we want to do is systematize it and really scale it across the whole state. So one, at first, we just needed to have a reduction in the oversupply of prescription opioids. So we had legislation that was passed last year, and I think a fair amount of success on really trying to turn down just the number of pills prescribed. So that's one bucket, and that relates directly to me and my colleagues and what we prescribe around pain medication.
Me too.
Next is around, and you too, thank you. and I want to say there's been a ton of partnership on that. That is, you know, whether it was the Medical Society, the Board of Medicine, or others have really picked up the mantle here and run with it in terms of, you know, just getting us all better educated about pain control, the addictive nature of these medicines. So I think that's all been really helpful. And then the second is we have to reduce the diversion of those prescription medicine to the street, and then we have to get our hands around the flow of illicit drugs. And this is where we need our law enforcement partners, and I was happy to see the FBI set up one of their 5 command centers around the country here in North Carolina, because I'm very concerned about the fact that heroin is cheap and very available. And so we need to get our hands around the supply of that, because as long as it is cheaper for folks to continue to use heroin as opposed to get treatment, like we're going to be facing such an uphill battle. Like, it's hard enough to fight an addiction, but then put the economics behind it and the money behind it. So we really need to change that equation for folks. And I think the law enforcement is doing a tremendous job, but we need to do it faster because folks are dying. And then the next aspect is really around community awareness and prevention. And so how do we make sure that folks are understanding this issue? Thank you for raising awareness of this issue on your show, but we need to do that more systemically. So we're working with the Attorney General's office and others to think about a communication plan. But we have a lot to learn in this space. Who are the right people to talk to? Do we talk to teenagers or younger? Do we talk to parents, both, everyone? So we have a lot to learn about who to talk to, what do we say, what are the right messages? So a lot more to come in that space. Next, we had a focus on making sure naloxone, that medicine that reverses overdose, widely available. So we at the department, for example, purchased 40,000 kits of naloxone, and we're able to distribute that across the state to our partners. Again, I think this is, you know, it's a Band-Aid. It is, and needs to be couched in this whole plan, but it does save lives. And so we want folks to have naloxone available if they are at risk for overdose. And
a powerful Band-Aid if it saves a life. That's a good Band-Aid.
Exactly. We'll take it. But really what we're focused on is that fifth aspect here is about treatment and recovery systems. And we know that opioid addiction is not a 30-day and done thing, right? This is a longer-term, probably lifelong process of recovering from an addiction. And so we want to make sure folks have access to medications like buprenorphine and others that can help folks really, you know, make sure they're not in high-risk situations and continuing to rely on heroin or fentanyl or others. But then get into long-term recovery, and that also means having access to insurance coverage, because recovery and treatment take, you know, doctor's visits and therapy and others, and folks need access to insurance coverage. And then the last aspect of our action plan is related to a coordinated infrastructure and metrics and holding ourselves accountable for, you know, for meeting goals. And that's a hard thing to do when these numbers are so hard to move, but felt like we needed to be transparent about where are the deaths, where are the emergency room numbers. I was just getting an update from my team on where things stand after the end of 2017. So we plan on putting out new data so that folks, again, can be responsive to the changing nature of this crisis and epidemic, and we can be more targeted in our resources. So I think we're making a lot of progress. I wouldn't say that the numbers bear that out yet. I still feel like we are going the wrong direction, but I think all of the work is certainly making an impact across our state.
Yeah, sometimes I think it's hard when we're in an epidemic to see the progress, but I can say for certain that this action plan will have impact if done well, and I have every reason to believe that. We'll put a copy of a link up to that plan on our Your Health website for our listeners to take a look at, because the transparency is really important. You know, I think a little bit about how we approached an issue like nicotine addiction, even in a state like North Carolina that had a history of celebrating tobacco culture, but yet we became one of the leaders nationally because we had a multi-prong in these coalitions. And, you know, the community education piece ultimately helped out a good deal. Do you have faith that a well-executed plan, conducted community education about this issue could have an impact?
I absolutely think it can, and I'm glad you brought up the relationship to smoking, because I think there's a lot of lessons we can and should learn from the prevention campaigns around smoking. And it took us a fair number of years to figure out what were the right messages and images and the right audiences for various messages. And so I think there's a lot we can learn from the smoking work that folks did. Actually, Dr. Susan Consagra, who leads our opioid work here at the department, was very involved in smoking cessation campaigns in New York City that were very successful. So I have full confidence in her and the rest of the team here to put together some good work. But I would say we have a lot to learn, and we want to do that learning as quick as possible. So, you know, that is very top of mind. I think it's necessary. I think it can work, but we just need to do some of the testing and the research to be really strategic, because, you know, everyone's time is short, dollars are short, so we want to make sure we're getting the key messages to the right folks when it's most impactful and when they can actually change someone's behavior.
Well, I know that there is a wise saying in religious literature that if you save one life, it is as if you have saved the world. And I know that as a provider and as a researcher and as a leader, you firmly believe that. And I want to really thank you for coming on Your Health and sharing the vision and helping lead the state of North Carolina and the country to make a difference on this and many of the other really serious epidemic issues facing us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Adam. It is my pleasure to be in this job every single day. I feel so blessed and lucky to have the opportunity, and really all the success is from a lot of hard work that's going on around the state, and we're just trying to accelerate it forward. So look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, with the rest of the community, and really just thank you for highlighting some of the important issues of the moment.
We've been talking with Dr. Mandy Cohen, Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, about her vision for health care for the people of North Carolina. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Nathan and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Nathan, if a listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they just need to send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call.
Recently, I think something in my diet has been causing stomach upset. What's the best way for me to begin to identify the food that's causing the trouble?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and there's some assumptions there that we could challenge, but we may be true. Like, is the food – we know what's going on with your stomach, and is the food causing it?
That's right. A lot of things cause stomach pain, not just food. Food is relatively common as a cause of stomach pain, and it's a pretty easy way to figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's really common for some people is if they've got allergies. So if they're really allergic to things like milk – or dairy, that could be a significant problem. But that should not be something that's all of a sudden just starts up if they've never had it before. You would think that that would be there more often. It wouldn't be something new and different. In this case, it sounds like something's changed. What sort of things go through your mind?
First thing that goes through the mind, and is somebody – well, they actually don't give us their age here. But in a younger person, I think about things like gastritis or change in medications, or maybe they're eating something different.
What medicines would have you like say, oh, this is a red flag?
The NSAID medications, things like aspirin and ibuprofen.
Right. Aleve, Advil, Goody powders, which we see down in the South quite a bit. Not so obvious, but yeah, those common things are really irritating. You would also wonder, have they been doing like drinking more coffee or drinking more alcohol, things that could erode the stomach and cause a problem? I would also worry about anxiety. You ever see anyone with anxiety coming in with kind of stomach pain?
Absolutely. There's a ton of neurons in the digestive tract and second only to our brain. So when we get upset, those start to fire in different ways.
Well, this is a good question. We appreciate it. And go see your doctor if you have any questions and kind of try to isolate what's new and different. Thank you. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a man in my late 20s, and at my last checkup, my doctor was a little surprised at my blood pressure. It was 137 over 84. I eat well and exercise multiple times a week, so I'm confused about this. Do you have any ideas why it might have been higher than she expected and what I should do to prevent problems?
Well, maybe someone read the recent change in guidelines for high blood pressure, because that would raise my blood pressure just knowing that a slightly higher blood pressure is considered more abnormal than in the past.
Yeah, it's hard to keep track of these changes that are coming seemingly every year from different organizations about what's a normal blood pressure and when blood pressure should be treated.
But this blood pressure 137 over 84 in someone in their 20s, that does raise my eyebrows. Like, oh, this is probably a little higher than it should be at that age.
Yeah, it definitely is when you consider that high blood pressure is a problem of accumulation over years. So constantly high blood pressure over decades typically is what causes problems later in life.
Now, this blood pressure, we wouldn't recommend medication, but we would say maybe find out if is it just that level when you go to see your doctor, or is it that way whenever you think about it, or that way whenever you're stressed or anxious, or that way all the time, regardless if you're stressed or anxious. That would suggest that there are things to do. We'd want to know about your weight. We'd want to know about your salt intake. We'd want to know about your alcohol use, your cigarette smoking. Anything that could be associated with this, maybe everyone in your family has high blood pressure, which means you probably will too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for a male in their late 20s, where we're considering maybe starting medication or doing something more drastic, this would be a good candidate for ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, which is wearing a blood pressure monitor for 24 hours at home through all of your activities of daily living to see exactly where your blood pressure typically is.
Good source of objective data to make a decision.
That's right.
Radical concept.
Mm-hmm.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
I really enjoy hiking, but as I get older, my knees are beginning to hurt after even a mild hike. I'm concerned this will only get worse. Is there anything I can do to keep them from deteriorating?
Well, you could avoid getting older. I think you must be 49 going on 50, because I know when you're 50 that just, you know, everything breaks loose here. But this is a common problem, right, where you have two different things that are going on here. One is you doing exercise that really takes, for a lot of people, muscles that they may not use as much, their quadriceps and their hamstrings, to be really strong. And the other is arthritis of the knees, which happens to a lot of people when they get older.
Yeah, and that can be challenging to people, especially people who have remained active their entire life, to get to a certain age where they can't do those things or have pain that stops them from doing things. And more often than not, this leads to more mental anguish than physical pain.
Yeah, one of the things I have discovered is almost no matter what the level of quote-unquote arthritis in your knees, people can benefit from quadriceps and hamstring strengthening. So seeing a physical therapist, seeing what type of exercises you can do that are not necessarily hiking, but that just strengthen the muscles that take pressure off of the knees, really good thing. People actually get better. Even people with severe arthritis can get better. So I would encourage you to talk with your doctor, talk with the physical therapist, get on a really good regimen that can strengthen those muscles.
Yeah, got to keep moving. You slow down, that will only make it worse.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've answered questions and concerns that are important to you in your health. And if you can send any question you want to yourhealth@unc.edu, you can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank great guest co-host Nathan Sison and our guest today, Dr. Mandy Cohn. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of your health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Nathan Sison.
And we look forward to seeing you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.